Hey.
Oh my god, hey.
Hey, girl.
Hey.
Hey, Threadlings.
Hey.
Wow.
What?
Jesus.
Didn't realize we'd started officially. Hey, Threadlings.
Hi, Threadlings.
Hey.
How y'all doing?
Happy musical month.
Musical month. It's a month of musicals, and we're gonna sing sometimes in this podcast. Whoo.
That was amazing.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Do you want to add a verse?
No, I think we established in the last episode that I'm tone deaf.
If it's your own song, you're not tone deaf.
I don't think that's true.
Welcome to Check Your Threading. This is a podcast that comes out twice a month, and it's all about movies and how we love them and all other things movie related. I don't know. I don't know.
What's wrong? Like having an existential crisis over there.
I just, like, I realized I don't have my normal spiel pulled up, and I was like, I'm just gonna wing it.
Yeah, it's good. It's fine. It's great.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I feel so validated right now.
Good.
Okay, so my name is Bonnie. I have a film theory background. I just spent about 10 hours yesterday at my job doing a festival revolving around dog and dogs in costumes and free stuff for dogs, and it was pretty awesome.
And what was it called?
It was called Poochamania.
Yes, Poochamania.
Woo! Poochamania.
Nice.
And what else? I just started Fleabag. Actually, Lauren and I both just started Fleabag, and it is awesome. So there you go. That's me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I am Lauren, and my background is in creative writing, and it's daylight savings. So, you know, sun went down at 4:30 today, and I will be entering the deep cave of Bostonian winter. So please send care packages, tiny boxes filled with sunlight to get me through until March, at least, I would say. Yeah.
It's 72 degrees here, and the sun is still up, like, not even setting yet.
Yeah, don't make me feel any worse, all right?
Sorry.
But that's why we have musicals, to make us happy when skies are gray.
That's so true.
Yeah.
So, this week, we're gonna talk about Velvet Goldmine.
Wow.
Yes. Ooh. That's not even remotely what Velvet Goldmine sounds like.
Whatever.
But my little introduction is that Velvet Goldmine was written and directed by Todd Haynes. The cinematography is by Maurice Alberti, Lady Cinematographers. What?
Noise.
Sandy Powell did the costume design. She's a 2-time Oscar winner, and she's really known, I think, for her, like, Victorian era style. Mm. Like, she's a costumer of Victorian pieces, I think.
How appropriate.
Right?
Yeah.
James Lyons edited and also has a writing credit for this film. So the IMDb summary is... In 1984, British journalist Arthur Stewart investigates the career of 1970s glam superstar Brian Slade, who was heavily influenced in his early years by hard-living and rebellious American singer Kurt Wilde. The film was originally titled Glitter Kids.
Oh no, that was a good choice to change.
In development, the original screenplay was titled Glam! Exclamation point.
So even that would have been okay. I mean, that's not off market.
It's also described as the glittery and gay Citizen Kane, which is just... Mwah.
Okay.
Especially considering Haynes has literally come out and said that he was using the bare bones of Citizen Kane as the narrative arc for the story.
Okay. Okay. So. All right. There's a whole lot of, like, rosebud, butthole,
Wow.
Jokes that I'm not going to make. I just wanted to get that out of my system.
I just want to throw it out there that Rosebud was a clitoris.
Well, not in Velvet Goldmine, Bonnie.
Sometimes in Velvet Goldmine.
Yeah, okay, but yeah, sometimes in Velvet Goldmine.
Not often.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so I was going to talk about the origin of glam rock. I'm aware that that's sort of a little bit like intentionally picking a fist fight with a stranger.
Oh, interesting, yeah.
Well, you know, people have strong opinions about musical history, and I am not an expert in anything. So here's what I could find on the internet, and I apologize if this contradicts one of your personal truths.
In fact, if it does contradict one of your personal truths, please send us messages because we like to hear that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
I am a glam rock lover, and there are bands that I found out about through researching this film and the history of glam rock that I didn't even know about before. So maybe you know one that could further expand our horizons.
Yes, totally. So a lot of this references a book called Shock and Awe by Simon Reynolds, which everybody seems to agree is like the book on the history of glam rock. He's a music journalist who has also done definitive works on other genres, but everyone was like super excited when he did the glam book. So here are some things that everyone generally seems to be able to agree on. In the late 1960s, a bunch of musicians were just exhausted with the denim tuxedo, tree-felling, earnest warbling of rock and roll taking itself really seriously. So think like the Allman Brothers, like Creedence Clearwater Revival, Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Like, okay, so that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
One article called it beardy earnestness. So in an effort to cast off the self-serious, masculine fatherliness of this vibe.
Oh, that's so legit.
I know, I hadn't even thought about it until I was reading this stuff. So glam rock goes and puts on mom's dress, sister's makeup, the tallest shoes you can find, and you just scream into the microphone because we're tired of this like earnest, polite folk music.
Sure.
And sort of similarly, there's also a lot of like innocent bubblegum pop happening in the late 60s.
Ugh.
And it's like glam rock showed up and was like, cool, but like, do you swing? So this sort of happened to coincide with an overall dissatisfaction around like, well, we don't want to be conservatives and we don't want to be hippies, but we do want freedom. So like, we need a new thing. Like, what's our new thing? And some historians, rightly, I think, can easily tie this to the nascent LGBT rights movement. We've got a group of very brave young people, or not young people sometimes, stepping out into the streets in the early 70s. And there's this electricity around wearing visible signals to other members of your community. For as much as that can also create like a dangerous target on your back. So this is the time of the UK's homosexual reform laws in 1967, which decriminalized homosexuality, and the Stonewall riots in the US in 1969. So basically we see the queer community on sort of both sides of the pond saying that they're like fucking fed up. To suddenly have a crowd of people who you can find, and we see this in Arthur in the movie, he's just like breathless with relief anytime he sees somebody wearing glitter or lipstick or like anyone who, you know, he can visually identify as like him.
Yeah.
And and his shoulders don't really come down from like around his ears until he finally leaves his home and gets around like the people who see him. And the sort of like inherent androgyny and genderfuck and identity as a performance inherent in glam implies that you absolutely could choose to be anyone that you wanted to be. And like they literally mean anyone. So there's this great quote from a New York Times op-ed piece that a guy wrote, which I will link in our thing, that says, "Glam sent mixed messages, brash riffs and blunt beats, but its vocals had a fruity theatricality. Glam was butch and femme at once, bisexuality and sound. The result reflected a double con, a movement created overwhelmingly by straight people, out to stoke attention by, quote, acting gay, and had special meaning for gay youth who felt the need to pass as straight." Which I thought was interesting, especially in the context of the film.
Yeah.
And glam was also considered very much the music of youth. David Bowie, Iggy Pop, T-Rex, the New York Dolls, Lou Reed, and other bands all talk about how they intentionally targeted high school students and college students when they were advertising their concerts and the radio stations they chose. They want to give the youth something to be passionate about and fight with their parents about.
Oh my God, did they say that?
Some of them, yeah.
Okay, I love that.
More like an Iggy Pop thing.
Nice.
So by and large, like, music critics didn't really know what to do with that.
Yeah.
A lot of traditional music critics criticized glam. There's this whole other story about how Cream Magazine rose to the fore of music journalism because they were, like, capable of being aware of how important these new groups were. And fans went just, like, bananas for these bands. So just like with the Beatles, we're sort of seeing fans just, like, screaming devotion against older critics and radio DJs who are sort of, like, frowning and tutting and, like, don't quite know, like, what to do with this crazy new music, which, like, I always feel is so bizarre because, like, if you are in the music industry, like, the new thing is normal. Like, get over yourself.
Yeah, for real.
So, you know who always wins?
Who?
Screaming teenagers. They do. They always win. Fighting teenagers almost always ends up with you on the wrong side of, like, cultural history.
Yeah.
And, you know, like young people, this music and its performers were changing every day, day to day, week to week, evolving, trying on new things, and, you know, embracing change most of all.
Yeah.
So the other thing I wanted to bring up outside of, like, the broad history of glam rock was its relationship as a genre with Oscar Wilde, because Oscar Wilde is sort of sprinkled throughout this movie like a bacon bit topping.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, we see this constant shifting identity also as a big part of Velvet Goldmine. And this is an idea that Oscar Wilde backs up in his plays and in his writing. And I know that Velvet Goldmine leans heavily on Oscar Wilde's dialogue, but I was also surprised to see how indoctrinated Oscar Wilde is into the glam identity outside of the film. So a ton of extremely formative events occurred at the Oscar Wilde room of the Mercer Arts Center in the Broadway Central Hotel in the early 70s. The New York Dolls used to perform weekly, and then also weekly there would be huge drag queen performances that are said to be sort of the origin of glam's wardrobe experimentation.
Interesting. So those are the things that happened at the Oscar Wilde room that started a movement, basically?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
And you know, and while we were watching this, Bonnie kept comparing glam and camp. And I think that they both embrace this, like, reality is boring, reach for the stars mentality. So this Oscar Wilde quote from Portrait of Dorian Gray kept showing up in, like, all of these articles that I was reading about the history of glam rock. Which is, quote, "Being natural is simply a pose, and the most irritating pose I know." And if that's not Brian Slade, I don't know what is.
Yeah, legit.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So knowing that that's where we're coming from, like, tell me about how we got to the creation of this movie and Todd Haynes, because I know he's kind of a unique director.
Yeah. So one funny thing about me is that I always mistake Todd Haynes for Todd Solondz, who did Welcome to the Dollhouse and Happiness and Palindromes.
Okay.
Which is, like, no, not even remotely the same people, but they do make very unique films. So that's why I'm always like, wait, which one?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Anyway. So Todd Haynes, he studied semiotics in college, which we discussed a while ago in reference to Nowhere, semiotics and symbols.
Oh, okay.
And, right. So just a quick reference to that. Semiotics are the studies of signs and symbols and their interpretations and or uses, right? So a good example is your Wi-Fi symbol on your phone or tablet. When you see that in a window in a coffee shop, you understand that this means the coffee shop has Wi-Fi.
Right.
And it's universal.
Yeah.
So I think that his background in semiotics actually really applies to Velvet Goldmine. You take the iconography and the historical structure of glam rock and everything surrounding it, and you get a movie that isn't so much about David Bowie and Iggy Pop and others as it is about the experience of glam rock as almost like a sentient being.
Totally.
In fact, this movie was originally supposed to be a pretty straightforward biopic about Bowie's life and his career, and fairly infamously, Bowie refused to give rights to Haynes for music and I think just his story in general, and even threatened Haynes with a lawsuit.
Oh, geez, okay.
But I would say arguably not having the rights to that, the songs and such, it actually makes the movie better. Brian Slade is less of an actual person and more pastiche and like a symbol of the overall culture.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah.
It also gave Haynes creative mobility to pay tribute to other important pioneers of the culture, such as Mark Bolan, of the band T-Rex, I believe he was the lead singer, and Joe Bryath, the first openly gay rock musician to have been signed to a major label.
Nice.
And one of the first internationally famous musicians to have died of AIDS. So I kind of feel like anyone who goes into Velvet Goldmine expecting it to be an unofficial Bowie film is going to be incredibly disappointed.
Yeah, totally.
Especially by the portrayal of the Bowie-ish character. Like, he's an artist who made his career of stealing and borrowing and basically using other people. And I don't think we're supposed to really like Brian.
Yeah.
I think we're supposed to want him, like, sexually want him.
Yeah.
Such as the way Kurt does, or Mandy, or even Arthur. Like, you want to be him, you know?
Yeah, totally.
But as an aside, because I want to defend David Bowie.
Okay.
I don't fault Slade for what he did necessarily when it comes to taking like the bits and pieces from other performers, because I think great performers and great artists will do that. They will steal and borrow and collaborate. But what I do think is like a main difference is it's a matter of honoring your sources. And I don't think Brian did that.
Yeah.
I think he took it and tried to make it his own,
yeah,
rather than, you know, the tribute.
That's really true.
And then, of course, after his faked assassination, Brian becomes this, like, commercialized, deeply masculine-presenting pop star, like, with the strong jaw and everything,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
He goes so far as to, like, bury his own past as the deliciously androgynous glam rock star. Like, he won't talk about it. He doesn't even acknowledge it. He's not even supposed to be the same person.
Right.
And honestly, again, that could be a cut on Bowie for, you know, how he assassinated Ziggy Stardust and then moved on to become a more commercially acceptable version of himself. But again, defending him, I personally think he was just trying to creatively move on, and he did that on his own terms.
Yeah, totally. Especially at the end of Bowie's career, sadly the end of his career, we can see how many times he reinvented himself.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And a quick historical fact about that, because I don't know how many people actually know that he killed off Ziggy. So he killed off his Ziggy Stardust character at the Hammersmith Odeon in 1973 at a live concert. He basically said, "We love you all, and this is the last time I'll ever see you." And then he sang Rock and Roll Suicide. It was a scene that was greatly exaggerated. Like, I went and I watched the live scene because they filmed it, and people were in the audience like crying and flipping out,
yeah,
like rioting,
okay,
practically, okay, over it. So, and then he says bye and he walks off stage, basically.
Wow.
So he wasn't shot. It was greatly exaggerated.
Yeah, of course. The death of Ziggy Stardust is open to interpretation.
Right. And I think that it was a scene that was beautifully portrayed in the way all have imagined to have seen it on stage in real life in the movie.
Yes, okay.
Like, he was basically shot in the chest on stage.
Right, yeah.
So,
That's pretty intense. That level of grief.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I, well, and like, you know, tying into this like idea of like, okay, we want to go after like our youth fan base and engage, you know, adolescents and young college students. And it's like, you feel so much at that age.
Yes.
Like everything is like 500%. So David Bowie, like your favorite idol, telling you that he's like gone forever.
Uh-huh.
No warning. Yeah, I can see how that might fuck you up a little bit.
Right. Ugh. Rude.
Or effective.
I know. I was going to say, I also respect it. Like, yeah, I really respect the performance there, the performance piece to moving on in your career.
Yeah. Also, I feel like it's worth mentioning, you mentioned Brian Slade's like new iteration, whose name I can never remember. So the first
Tommy Stone.
So the first time I saw this, literally like without a shadow of a doubt, I thought Tommy Stone was a televangelist.
Oh my God, you're so right.
Like, I think it took me like a couple viewings to realize that he was a musician and not like a faith-based entertainment act.
Well, yeah, and he's all for the president and all that other stuff,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
There was a piece I read in the AV Club that I'll have to link on our website. It's about how it's 1984 and it's very clearly Orwellian.
Mm, mm-hmm.
The stage of 1984 is bleak. It's industrial. It's like glam rock is dead and gone. Mm-hmm. And this is what we have left. And the only pop stars you see are on these huge screens or at these news release. Press releases, mm-hmm. talking about how great the president is.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, totally.
And this, like, Arthur guy is running off to go find the truth about the time when these people used to be alive and things were better.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, totally.
And nothing hurt.
Except everything hurt.
Except everything.
Oh, man. Okay. Okay.
You just want to, no transition? You just want to...
No, I got, you know.
You got something?
Yeah, sort of.
Okay.
Okay, so...
Speaking of 1984...
Oh, speaking of Margaret Thatcher... so I feel like a big part of Velvet Goldmine, at least for us, is that it's steeped in personal history. So
yes.
I appreciate our analysis of the film, but I also want to get to question time because I feel like we have more to talk about there than usual.
Yes.
Okay. As a young person coming of age in Texas, as a young queer person who may not have even realized that about themselves yet, what did this movie mean to you?
So, growing up in a super conservative town in Texas and having access, like, every single movie I had access to that was not like Braveheart. My dad loved historical dramas. He loves historical dramas. And I can't blame him because I think they're great.
Mm-hmm.
But also when we were going to Blockbuster to rent movies, we were going for one specific thing only because everything else was covered in sin.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
So somehow Velvet Goldmine, I got my paws on the same weekend when my dad wouldn't let me rent Can't Hardly Wait.
Oh my God, which is a whole other anecdote I know about, so I love that these are together.
So, you know, he didn't really want to watch it, but he lets me, like, do my own thing, like, when he's at work or something like that. So it had freshly come out, you know, very short amount of time to watch it. So one day when my dad was at work, this is a very long story, I'm sorry.
Don't apologize.
Don't tell me what to do.
Yeah, fine.
So I pop it in, VHS, and, like, from the moment it started, I had no fucking idea what to do with myself. I, like, it's so gay. It's the gayest movie. And this is in 1998 when nothing could be that explicitly gay, but Todd Haynes was just like, oh, gay. More gay.
It's not gay enough.
And so it's like, it's deliciously, unapologetically gay, all right? And like, it was so close to when I watched Nowhere for the first time, you know? But movies like this, like, they rocked my fucking world.
Okay.
I just, like, I was so turned on and confused and, like, completely flabbergasted by what I was seeing because, like, I was seeing something that I understood on a deeper level than I really understood at the time.
Sure. Yeah. We, like, there were no words for this yet.
Yeah. A part of me identified deeply with these characters in a way that I was like, I'm not a fucking rock star. Why am I identifying with these guys?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, totally.
And I was also struggling a lot with my gender at that time, more silently than my sexuality. And till the day I fucking die, I will never forget the scene where Mandy and Brian are having sex that first time, and it's like all like those pretty like fairy lights, and they're speaking in Oscar Wilde tongue, mm-hmm, and like naked and wrapped up in each other. Whose body is whose? I don't know. I can't tell. I don't know who is in this situation. And it was so exhilarating and scary. And like, I couldn't tell.
I love that.
And that was amazing to me.
I love that because like literally when we watched it, I was thinking about that, but not at all in that context. So I love that. I just love that you brought that up.
It was not just for glitter dicks.
No, of course. I mean,
although that was a moment where I was like, Obi-Wan?
Yes.
Yes, hello. This is my real lightsaber.
Oh my God. Still blue.
Is it blue in the movie?
I think so.
No, don't look. Yeah, so I mean that was also a whole different experience for me that was really just about like the kind of people that I'm attracted to.
Sure.
But like as far as queerness and gender, it like, yeah, those are the big things I think of most.
Okay. Nice.
Whew. Good
it's
stuff.
Like tears in my eyes from laughing.
My question is, Velvet Goldmine is all about a feeling. So what feelings did you feel when you watched Velvet Goldmine for the first time?
Oh my gosh. So amazingly, the first time I watched Velvet Goldmine, it was on television and unedited, which makes no sense to me.
Dicks and everything?
Yes, because I remember being like, oh my God, dicks. Oh my God, Ewan McGregor. but it must have been like after 10 p.m. on like the independent. You remember like there used to be like an indie movie channel or something?
Yeah.
Something like that. Because I definitely remember like turning the volume down and closing the living room door so that it like wouldn't wake my parents up because I was like, what is going on? So there was definitely a sense of exhilaration.
Yes.
Hiding, almost like watching porn and not wanting to get caught.
Yeah.
And similar to you, just like, I shouldn't say similar to you. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but sort of an overwhelming just sense of intense sexuality and sensuality and not ever really having seen that in a movie that was accessible to me before.
Right.
Like, I was 13. I wasn't watching, like Water for Chocolate or whatever the, you know, equivalent was at the time.
The hetero equivalent, though.
Yeah. I should say the dramatic equivalent, because I don't think that Velvet Goldmine is a drama, per se.
Right. I hear you on that.
Yeah. So this was definitely the first time that I could, like, actually, like, I felt engaged by a movie that was trying to talk to me about sex. And other things, but I was 13, so, or 14 maybe, so mostly it was sex at the time.
What?
Yeah, literally, like my whole face was probably like beet red the entire movie. Like I can't even imagine. And also, I do think that it's worth saying that the first time I watched it, I really, really liked Brian. Like he was flawless in my mind. It took me many subsequent viewings to realize that he was kind of a shitheel.
Yeah.
Which is not uncommon with my pattern of admiration for men from the 90s to now.
Yeah.
So
the different, Lauren and I were talking about it, and it took her a long time to get to the point of realizing that Mandy is like a very deeply sympathetic character.
Yes, totally. I was very, for a very long time, I did not like Mandy because I felt like she got in the way of Brian and Kurt. And I am not that person anymore. but I do, I hadn't seen the movie since I had shifted my thinking on that. And watching it this last time really made me realize what a deeply sympathetic character she is. And
yeah.
How completely wronged she and Kurt were, and how much mm-hmm. it sort of means to see them together at the end. Like, they have a moment of closure together that I think implies an extended, at least platonic relationship post Brian Slade.
Yeah.
And I kind of love that. This has nothing to do with Question Time, but, and I've told this to Bonnie before, like, a part of me dies inside knowing that there's like a huge chunk of footage that Todd Haynes cut out, and it's just it's just destroyed. It's not sitting on anyone's shelf. It's not like they literally destroyed the celluloid.
Yeah.
And there's so much more to this story that we could have found out about if it hadn't been so aggressively edited.
Well, and then they also had their budget cut by, I think, like $9 million or something because a funder pulled out. So they had like so much less time to also like let the story breathe as well. But all that being said, like all those roadblocks and you still get this iconic, fantastic movie. Like, good job, everyone.
Yeah. This, it's hard to believe that this movie is 22 years old.
Yeah.
It really holds up.
It truly.
Ewan McGregor also really holds up.
I know. I was just thinking that. Yes. Oh, Lord. Oh, Lord.
All right. So, takeaways?
Oh, see, we can't segue nicely into Question Time and then not at least try.
Okay. All
for
right.
takeaways.
Okay. So, you might say that you want to take Ewan McGregor away to your bedroom.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Is that a bad? Okay, I'll do a real one.
No, it's fine. That's no. good.
Are you sure?
That's good. It was perfect.
Okay. So maybe you can share some of your other takeaways with me.
Yeah. So as I mentioned before, this movie isn't about any one person. It's about a feeling. It's about the way Iggy Pop and David Bowie and, you know, Mark Bolan and Joe Bryath and Lou Reed make you feel. It's the way they shaped us when we were young.
Yeah. I really, you mentioning the thing about Todd Haynes studying like simulacra, basically,
mm-hmm.
it really mm-hmm. just made like all these puzzle pieces come together.
Right?
Because like the whole movie is basically a symbol, or, you know, obviously we have like the little green gem, like that's a symbol. But like even Brian Slade in and of himself being like a symbol, he's not a person. He's an idea.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm just repeating the things that you're saying, but like, it
no,
totally
it's okay.
Like, oh, wow.
One thing that I read, damn it, I can't remember where, but I'll try and find the article, was about how that little green gem is a symbol for the generational moving forward of a movement, specifically sure. LGBT elders giving wisdom and power to the younger generations to move forward.
Okay.
And I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah, it's interesting that they show both the giving and the taking mm-hmm. in that idea, because yeah, sometimes
Brian.
I know.
What a great name to just be like, come on, Brian.
Brian! Yeah. it's great. Did you have any other takeaways?
This movie is gay.
Fuck yeah.
It's one of the gayest movies I've ever seen, like, even today. Like, I still go back and I watch it. I'm like, that movie is so fucking gay. I love it.
This is like gay Thanksgiving dinner. Yes. Velvet Goldmine.
Yeah. So there great. You go. That's okay. what I got.
All right. So one of my takeaways was, I guess the idea that you can sort of use these celebrities as a vehicle to get where you need to go, but you can't trust them to stick around. And that's not always necessarily like a cynical thing, but I do think that we see Arthur sort of going through these growing pains of like, he learns who he is through his love of the music that's created by Brian Slade, and then has to go beyond what that music could give him. And he, you know, he does that by finding other people in the community and moving and leaving his home and getting involved in the music scene itself. But it could have been some other thing. It didn't have to be the music scene. Like, that's such a clean path. But I do feel like we see that a lot, especially as like we go through this idea of celebrity as like this infallible thing. But like the more and more we find out about celebrities, like the worse they are.
And that was the beauty of Kurt, was he was, we saw him as celebrity and as performer, but we get to also see him as a human being too.
We sort of know how bad Kurt is when we meet him. Like, it's like it's all out there. There's a baseline. And if the worst that he does after that is disappoint Brian, like, well, oh well.
Right.
Still all right.
And he's clearly doing something with Jack at some point, and they're all, like, you know, doing their own thing as artists still, at the point of 1984. It's just not the big glam scene that it once was.
Yeah,
it's become something else.
And, like, maybe that's okay.
In that same article that, again, I will find for everyone, also about that green stone, you know, Kurt giving it to Arthur is a kind of a symbol of like, yes, you may have grown up and you may have stopped wearing glitter and dyeing your hair and like, you know, acting and dressing like your favorite rock stars, but whatever that meant to you was real and continues to be real and continues to live inside you. You know, so carry it with you that, you
know.
I
love that. Yeah, that's legitimate. That, and that's like, maybe that's, maybe it's that we are now watching this movie 22 years later and we're sort of in that same space as it's been 20 years for them. But like, I really feel that. So I was going to end, not with a second takeaway, but with perhaps a takeaway from Mr. McGregor himself. Because I did some Googling and I wanted, I always like to know, like, movies that mean a lot to me, I also want the actors to not hate them. And so I looked up Ewan McGregor because Jonathan Rhys-Meyers is kind of a butthole about things in general. But so Ewan McGregor is talking about the movie. This is long after it came out. And he's saying, I watched this documentary about a photographer, Nan Golden, of the New York gay scene in the 70s and 80s. She said she took photographs because otherwise she wouldn't remember where she'd been. So they were like a pictorial memory. And then when AIDS kicked in, her photographs went from being a record of the massive happy energy of that scene into memories of her friends dying. In a way, Velvet Goldmine's like that. I still don't know why people are so reluctant to talk about the 70s. What was going on that we were running away from? Look at film of Ziggy Stardust on stage. How can there be any doubt about what image David Bowie was trying to convey? Why shy away from it now?
I love that.
It just felt very like, this is still a necessary conversation. It's still something we should be more proud of and accepting of than we are.
Yeah, and to me that also, first off, I love Nan Golden so much, and love that he did that. And I also think about how, you know, the transition of this glam rock world in the, you know, mid-70s to this Orwellian future, like the AIDS crisis was just on the horizon when Brian, I think when he basically committed suicide on stage or got assassinated. And then the AIDS crisis hits and it's like, yeah, the future is hard and it's rough, but Arthur has that jewel now and he's going to go forward and be a an amazing journalist and maybe get things going again. I don't necessarily know where I'm going with this, but
well, I do think it ties into what you just said about like the passing of the generational torch in the LGBT community, and like we don't know what magic Arthur is going to summon with his jewel. Maybe what the community needs in a post-glam world is just like truth and just talking about it, which like as a journalist, he's well positioned to create. We don't know, but at least in 2019, we know that things got a little bit better.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I guess it's time for you to take us away, Lauren.
All right.
The way you want to take Ewan McGregor to your bedroom.
I do.
Oh, before we go, I will also say that not only Ewan McGregor, but also Toni Collette dazzled me as a teenager. I was just enamored with her. She's so gorgeous.
I can't imagine, because like Bonnie's like a big Toni Collette fan, everybody. Yeah. I feel like you need to know. Like, I was not a Toni Collette fan, which now I suspect I should probably blame on my previous opinions about Velvet Goldmine. Took me a while to warm up to Toni Collette in general. And it was because you made me watch more of her movies. So big Toni Collette fan in this household. Looking forward to Knives Out.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to subscribe. Footnotes for every episode are available at checkyourthreading.com, and you can also find us on Twitter at checkthreading or Instagram at checkyourthreading. You can also email makeup tips and your favorite glam playlists to checkyourthreadingpod@gmail.com. If you're interested in supporting this podcast with money, we can be found on Patreon at checkyourthreading. Bonus episodes can now be subscribed to on a per creation basis.
So next time we will be watching... We're going to a rumble. Oh my God. Da-dun.
Gonna stab him in his handsome face.
So not Bob's Burgers, but West Side Story.
Nice, nice. I look forward to it.
Yeah, yeah. Bye, Threadlings.
Bye.